This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. Today's reading is from the Territorial News newspaper, published January 8, 2025. The title is Joaquin Moretta, California Outlaw Owes Fame to a Dime Novel, by Michael Murphy. Sometimes called the Robin Hood of El Dorado, Joaquin Moretta was well known during California's gold rush days as a folk hero for the resistance of indigenous Native American and Mexican people against white intrusion. Few historical figures are as mysterious and controversial as Moretta. While there is a general agreement that a man of that name led a band of outlaws in California in the early 1850s, fact has become confused with fiction ever since the 1854 publication of John Rollins Ridge's dime novel, The Life and Adventures of Joaquin Moretta, portraying a dashing romantic figure avenging wrong. The legends describe Joaquin as a peaceful man working as a miner who loses his claim due to the Unjust Foreign Miners Tax Act, and who, along with his young wife and his brother, are the subject of racial abuse by white settlers. After being falsely accused of stealing a mule, Joaquin was horsewhipped, and his brother was lynched. Some stories say his wife was sexually assaulted and murdered. We know from church records that Joaquin was born in the southern part of the Mexican state of Sonora in 1830 to Joaquin and Rosalie Moretta. The young Joaquin eventually married Rosa Falez of Facara. They, along with Jesus Moretta and Rosa's three brothers, went to California upon news of the gold strike. Rosa's brother, Claudio Feliz, began gold mining with Anglo partners near Sonora, while Joaquin and his bride eventually moved to Niles Canyon, then part of Contra Costa County. In these early years, there is evidence that Joaquin worked as a vaquero near Oakley and Brentwood in 1850 and as a Mustang catcher. From court records and newspaper accounts, the first we hear of the Morado Falez clan's dealings with the law was in Stockton in 1849, when Claudio was arrested for stealing another miner's gold. The evidence of his guilt proved overwhelming, but Claudio was able to escape from jail and launch a new career. By 1850, he was the leader of one of the most vicious bands of outlaws to have ever preyed upon the Anglo, Oriental, and Hispanic inhabitants of California. The first known attack by Claudio Feliz's gang occurred in Contra Costa County on December 5, 1850. Under the cover of darkness, a dozen armed men attacked the John Marsh Ranch, quickly subdued and robbed Marsh and his servants, and killed an unarmed Anglo visitor. 10 days later, the gang of desperados, including several white men, hit the ranch of Digby Smith near San Jose. After everyone was tied up, Digby's skull was crushed, another settler had his head split open by an axe, and the cook's head was severed. The ranch house was burned to the ground. In February, Claudio's gang struck again at the ranch of a native California, Antasquio Cabala, only 2 miles from San Jose. This time, his intended victims were on guard, and the well-armed ranch hands fought off the outlaws. The band of killers retreated to the gold country of the Sierra foothills, where they committed numerous robberies and murders. They specialized in attacking lone travelers, following a very successful, proven criminal plan of dead men tell no tales. We know that by 1851, Joaquin, along with Reyes's Falez, Claudio's brother, had joined the gang and were learning the killer's trade. Claudio carried on in his equal opportunity killer. He was never shy about robbing and murdering fellow Hispanics, as well as Chinese, Anglos, and African Americans. As pressure from the authorities mounted, Joaquin and Claudio's brother Reyes left the Feliz gang for the relative safety of Los Angeles. Unable to stay out of trouble, Joaquin and Reyes were soon implicated in the shooting death of General Joshua Bean, a major general in the state militia. Enraged, the Los Angeles Vigilance Committee arrested Reyes along with several members of the notorious Southern California Solomon Pico gang. Joaquin abandoned Reyes to his fate and immediately returned to the gold camps. Reyes Velez was later hung for the murder of General Bean. In September 1851, Claudio raided John Cottinger's ranch in Pleasanton but was repelled. He next made the fatal mistake of leaving a robbery victim alive, a member of an old Monterey County family named Acapito. In that part of California, the old Hispanic families were politically powerful and deadly serious about enforcing the law. And by robbing a fellow Hispanic, Claudio lost the protection of his fellow countrymen. Claudio and his gang soon ran out of luck and were cornered by lawmen. During the ensuing gun battle, Claudio Feliz was shot and killed. Leadership of the remaining members of the gang soon passed to Joaquin Moreto, and shortly afterwards there began the short, bloody crime spree that was to make the name of Joaquin Moreto infamous throughout California. Chinese miners were a favorite target of Joaquin and his gang because they tended to be unarmed and docile. Many of them were killed, apparently just for the pleasure it gave the outlaws. Over a span of 2 months, the Mexican bandits killed 22 men, most of them Chinese. By now, Joaquin's face was too well known in the mining camps for his personal safety. During March 1853, the gang vanished into the wilderness of the remote San Joaquin Valley. A troop of state rangers was organized to track down Moreto under the leadership of Harry Love, a hard-fighting frontiersman. The state paid the rangers $150 a month and promised them a $1,000 governor's reward if they captured the wanted men. The lawmen had little success until they captured Jesus Feliz, the youngest and last remaining Feliz brother. Jesus informed on the Murrieta gang's hideout. Some have speculated that he may have held a grudge against Joaquin for deserting his older brother Reyes in Los Angeles. And there is some evidence that Joaquin may have been the real killer of General Bean. Based on the information from Jesus Feliz, Harry Love's Rangers captured the Moreta gang on July 25, 1853, killing Joaquin during a running gunfight. As proof of the outlaw's death, the rangers cut off Marietta's head, preserving it in a jar of alcohol. After showing the severed head to the proper authorities, Love and his rangers received the $1,000 reward money. Officials later displayed the jar of remains in Mariposa County, Stockton, and San Francisco, charging spectators $1 to see the relic. In August 1853, an anonymous Los Angeles-based man wrote to the San Francisco Alta California Daily, claiming that Love and his rangers didn't kill the outlaws, but had murdered some innocent Mexican horse traders and bribed people to swear out false affidavits as to their identities. It didn't take long for Joaquin's folk hero legend to take root. John Rollin Ridge's little 90-page book, The Life and Adventures of Joaquin Moreta, the celebrated California bandit, was published in 1854, about a year after the outlaw's death. Filled with florid imaginary conversations between Joaquin and his men, this tiny book proved wildly popular. 5 years later, an anonymous writer for the California Police Gazette plagiarized Ridge's work and republished it under the title The Life of Joaquin Moretta, Brigadier Chief of California. This new version was even more popular than the original. However, the writer made a few changes to the story. In the new book, Joaquin's wife was called Carmela rather than Rosa. Now, after she was assaulted, American miners killed her. Also, Joaquin had acquired a beautiful mistress, Clarina. This altered narrative soon appeared in Spain, with a story of a brave Joaquin fighting personal injustice became nearly as popular as it was in California. Then some French plagiarists picked it up. From there, it appeared in Chile, where it was translated from French back into Spanish. Here, Marietta loses his Mexican citizenship and becomes a Chilean, el bandito chileno. In fact, Joaquin became so popular among his fellow countrymen that a statue was erected in Chile dedicated to the memory of this brave Chilean fighter against injustice. Spanish publishers stole the Chilean version and republished the book as El Caballero Chileno by a professor, a cigar. Then the Mexicans published the book and changed Joaquin back into a Mexican. The stage drama of Ridge's original version was written by Charles Howe and added to the legend by having San Joaquin County offer a $5,000 reward for Joaquin, dead or alive. Later writers reported as a fact that the state of California had made the offer and that Joaquin had written on the wanted poster, "I will give $10,000," and signed it. Great drama, but no such public rewards were ever offered by either the state or the county. Later, writer Sinacios Heimer Miller wrote a long and very amateurish poem called Joaquin. In the poem, Miller gave Marietta a deep knife scar across his forehead. The public picked up this imaginary scar from the poem, and soon eyewitnesses described the fictional scar in great detail. In the 1880s, Miller's poem became popular on the East Coast. There, the Marietta legend grew in strength, and his story was republished in numerous dime novels, such as Joaquin the Saddle King and Joaquin the Claude Duval of California. Noted historian Herbert Howe Bancroft legitimized Ridge's fictionalized version of Joaquin as a daring Mexican Robin Hood. He dubiously used Ridge's third edition, published soon after John Ridge's death in 1871, as a primary source. Bancroft added new quotes from newspapers concerning Joaquin's pickled head and the damage to California history was done. Another historian of the time, Theodore Heidel, also wrote about Marietta, but used Ridge only as a secondary source. Heidel warned the reader that the sources Ridge used were, to a great extent, unreliable. Heidel wrote that Marietta was never anything but a vicious and abandoned character, low, brutal, and cruel, intrinsically and at heart a thief and a cutthroat. Unfortunately, his words were too little and too late. The public only saw that the tale was in the famous Bancroft history, so therefore it must be true. Now, with the apparent scholarly blessing of Herbert Bancroft, magazines picked up the Joaquin legend and soon created an explosion of old-timers' remembrances. In the 1890s, every pioneer writing about his adventures in early California had recollections of Marietta and his non-existent fearsome scar. Even the famed explorer Charles Fremont wrote that Joaquin Marietta was a member of one of his early California expeditions. clearly a historical improbability given Joaquin's established age. In the numerous stories told by old 49ers, details were often contradictory with many facts drawn from the popular Ridge story or its many variants. In some tales, the old-timer swore Murrieta was blue-eyed and blonde, and in others he was brown-eyed with curly black hair. Many local pioneer families in Contra Costa and Alameda counties have fascinating but suspect stories of various handsome, mysterious strangers who appeared at the ranch house doors, who, to everyone's astonishment, later turned out to be none other than Joaquin himself. Nearly every East Bay hill with a cave or hollow is credited with once being a Murrieta hideout. As for the head in the jar, in 1879 it was reported that Murrieta's sister denied that the displayed head was her brother's. At around the same time, numerous sightings were reported of Murrieta very much alive as a middle-aged man. These were never confirmed. It's also been said that early 20th century writer Johnston McCulley based his character Don Diego de la Vega, better known as Zorro, on Ridge's account. For some political activists of the late 20th and early 21st centuries, Murrieta has symbolized Mexican resistance against white domination of California, as Native Americans and Mexicans were there first. An organization known as the Association of Descendants of Joaquin Murrieta says that Murrieta was not a gringo eater, but merely wanted to retrieve the part of Mexico that was lost at the time in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo after the Mexican-American War. So it seems that for every fact that one historian asserts about Murrieta's brief criminal rampage during the California Gold Rush, another historian has evidence to refute it. The full truth about Joaquin Murrieta will probably never be known. What we do know is that Joaquin began his outlaw career in the footsteps of his brother-in-law. Greed, not social injustice, was responsible for his turning outlaw. There was no evidence from either court records or newspaper clippings of whipping, the ravishing of his bride, or the loss of a mining claim. Women and rape were extremely rare in the gold fields, and was extensively reported when it occurred. We know that Joaquin's brother was neither lynched as was commonly reported. He returned to Mexico, and according to family records, was still alive in the 1860s. Death Valley, Shorty Borden. Death Valley is an extremely harsh and foreboding environment. The heat and scarcity of water are only two of the trials that confront anyone who attempts to spend time there. One man who fell in love with the desert landscape despite all of its hardships was Alexander Zachariah Borden. Alexander, or Shorty, as he was called, came to Death Valley to prospect for gold. He spent many years searching and had some limited success at several spots in the surrounding mountains, but he gained an intimate knowledge of the area and was able to locate water, something every bit as valuable as gold in the desert. That location became known on maps as Shorty's Well, in honor of its discoverer. Shorty was a friendly man and known for his hospitality. He was among the last of the old-time prospectors, and he was full of stories about the people and places of Death Valley. Shorty was a small man, but in very good shape. He had a peculiar shuffling gait that belied his ability to walk dozens of miles at a stretch through the mountainous terrain. Those individuals invited by Shorty for a hike often regretted it. Shorty met up with a man named Bud Saylor while in San Francisco, and the two became friends. Saylor had just returned from the Yukon goldfields, luckless and broke. Shorty's tales about the wonders of Death Valley sounded pretty good to Saylor after the icy cold of the Klondike, and the two agreed to a partnership. After spending some time in Death Valley, Sailor believed he knew where the mother lode of gold could be found. He was convinced they would make a big strike near Anvil Spring, somewhere in Butte Valley, a high basin rimmed by mountains, south of Telescope Peak. Sailor and Shorty laid claim to an abandoned cabin and prospected in the area for a while. Eventually, Shorty got tired of searching and decided to go out and explore another area in the valley on his own, a place he had found years before. Shorty had found the hidden valley of Hanapaw County as one of his earlier prospecting circuits, 5,000 feet up in the Panamint Mountains. There was a mountain brook lined with watercress and shaded with cottonwood trees, a welcome refuge from the desert. There was grass in the side canyons for his mules. There was plenty of scenery and even some nearby Indian caves. Shorty liked the canyon so much that he thought about turning it into a tourist attraction. With a little road improvement and some building development, he reasoned, the area could be a beautiful retreat. One July day, as Shorty was prospecting his mountainside paradise, a sudden storm arose. Water poured from the sky, filling washes and gullies and speeding down towards Hanapaw Canyon. In the narrow gorge, the torrent of water gained strength with every turn, carrying boulders and debris in a high, crashing wall. Shorty heard it coming, and he sprinted for higher ground just as the violent flow burst through his camp and swept it downstream. The waters quickly receded, but the flood had taken everything he had, including his hat, down into the valley below. Although he was a toughened desert veteran, Shorty was in trouble. His only recourse was to walk out of the canyon and across the desert flats to Furnace Creek. He left at dusk. Normally, the hike to Furnace Creek would have been a breeze for Shorty, but at the mouth of the canyon, the torrent had created a sea of mud and debris that was almost impassable. Shorty spent most of the night negotiating the thick, sticky mud. By morning, he had only reached the edge of the quagmire. By mid-morning, the sun had blistered his hatless head. By the time he crossed the salt flat near Devil's Golf Course that afternoon, he had started seeing visions of water. He imagined a rippling blue lake just ahead. After that, he remembered nothing. At Furnace Creek, a man named Monroe Wagnon was taking some trash out to his incinerator. Out of the corner of his eye, he thought he saw something move. In the 120-plus degree heat, he thought he must have been seeing things. But in the distance, interspersed with the heat waves, he did see as something was moving. It was Shorty Borden. Wagnon rescued Shorty, wrapping him in wet blankets and soaking him in a cool bath. Shorty's withered skin regained its tone. His strength returned. His color came back. Then his appetite. And finally, he felt better. However, Shorty was not one to lie around recovering. After 3 days, less than a week after the flood in Hanapaw Canyon, he decided he had recuperated enough. He wanted to travel up to Anvil Spring to see how Sailor was coming along. Shorty filled a canteen, took some bread from the kitchen, thanked his benefactor, and on the evening of the fourth day struck out for Sailor's Canyon. Unfortunately, Shorty had overestimated the resiliency of his own body. He simply hadn't recovered yet from his ordeals. The next morning, he staggered onto the flat at the Eagle Borax Mill. He was able to get water from a well there, and he started back out only to turn back to the mill. His strength was spent. Hunger was sapping his remaining resources. At dusk, he tried heading out one more time to reach his goal. Meanwhile, back at Furnace Creek, Wagnon had been worrying about Shorty. Finally, he decided to get in his car and drive up to Anvil Spring to see if Shorty was all right. That evening, as he came out of the bottom of Warm Springs Canyon onto the valley floor, He hadn't gone far when he found Shorty laying among the mesquite bushes near the side of the road. Once again, Wagnon revived Shorty, and once again, Shorty fully recovered. He lived for many years after that, finally dying in a rest home in San Bernardino. Arizona, Web of Time by Jim Harvey. The sedimentary rock at Monument Valley in Navajo Country was created beginning 284 million years ago. At that time, Monument Valley was a large plain crisscrossed by rivers. In modern times, the place has been the setting for many motion pictures, including some starring John Wayne. On an 1878 summer visit to the Grand Canyon's Havasu Valley, Indians, a group of white men exploring the country, sampled bread made from ground sunflower seeds. The Havasupai, who welcome visitors today, also raised peaches, watermelons, corn, beans, and pumpkins. 1888 Christmas gifts sold by stores in Williams included glassware, clocks, teapots, notepaper, silk handkerchiefs, sleeve holders, rubber dolls and wooden toys, chocolate, hard candy, and oysters. 1888 was the year the Kodak camera was introduced and the first electric automobile was demonstrated. Stagecoaches were replaced by a railroad hauling passengers from Williams to the Grand Canyon in 1901. The train still is in operation 7 days a week. When Arizona Highways magazine began publication in 1925, less than 200 miles of road were paved in the state. A gasoline tax of 3 cents a gallon paid for additional paving and other improvements. This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, all lowercase. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.